They're such product of those times: goodness, passion, and ignorance. So this languid malaise comes from the third mode, tamagun, or ignorance. And the Bhagavad Gita said that ignorance is characterized by sleep, laziness, sometimes madness, illusion, pramada, lasya nidra, vistam nidhatiya. These, the soul becomes bound by these qualities, by ignorance, by sleep, by depression, by more than lethargy, apathy. There's ignorance. Then we come to the mode of passion. It's quite different. Everybody's charged up. And it's not that the whole world is just, it's got the charged up section too. We're going to get things going. We have a program to change the world. We're going to start a corporation. We're going to start a business. We're going to revolutionize the way people do X. We're going to, and they're not at all lethargic. They're up till 2 a.m. working on spreadsheets and working on Microsoft Project, and they're working on this and they're working on that, and we can do this and we can do that, and we can do this and we can do that, and they're charged up. And plus, after we get off the work, then we can go find Susie, and then we can do this and that. Just the opposite of lethargy, all charged up. But what's getting them charged up? It's greed, extreme desire to have and to enjoy, to enjoy more, to have more. To control, that's passion. In the mode of passion, there's an abundance, overabundance of activity. And in the mode of goodness, satvam sanjayate gyan, in the mode of goodness, there's peace, there's quiet, there's thoughtfulness, there's simplicity, there's knowledge. This is the mode of goodness. And there's activity in goodness also, but it's not frenetic activity, it's not wild activity or activity driven by thirst for enjoyment. Intelligent activity, especially aimed at self-realization. So in the present age, a problem is that there's excessive passion and ignorance. And goodness is diminished. In previous ages, the Vedic literature describes that goodness was prominent. And therefore, the society was peaceful, people were peaceful, and the goal of society essentially was to make spiritual progress and to get free from material bondage. But as things deteriorate, we come to a society where passion is considered advanced and ignorance is either predominant or very prominent. So we find these two things, passion and ignorance. A little goodness, but not very much. So that's the picture we get. But Krishna says that even the mode of goodness is binding. It binds us to a sense of satisfaction and complacency. That I have my natural food, I have my peaceful place by the riverside, I have my library, and I have my simple daily routine, and therefore, I don't need anything more. And one doesn't go beyond the sense that the world is pretty good after all, because you have has this nice, peaceful arrangement for you. And one loses the thread that material world, after all, is a place of birth and death, a place of disease and old age, and we can't stay here. So one has to solve these problems. So even the mode of goodness is binding. And therefore, Krishna says, Nishkaigunya Bhavarti, we should go beyond all three modes of nature and come to the transcendental platform, the spiritual platform. These are three material modes. And above these three material modes or qualities is the spiritual platform, which is the natural platform for the living being, because as living beings, we're spiritual. The connection with these three material modes is superfluous or unnecessary and unnatural for us. And therefore, Krishna advises to rise above these three qualities and be transcendentally situated. So the purpose of this chanting, is to bring us to that transcendental platform, spiritual platform, above the three qualities of material nature, so that we'll be neither languid and lethargic in ignorance, nor frenetic and greedy in passion, nor complacent in goodness. We'll be on the higher platform, the spiritual platform. Good? Okay. That can serve as an introduction, and I wonder what sort of questions you might have. Anything goes.
Well, I thought Jagannath was this a thought-provoking idea that this type of lethargy can be caused by an overload, like an overabundance of information, you're saying? Like, you know, we just have all of these different things from society, from media, and from different sources that are thrown at us that we said we, like, just don't even take things to heart anymore because there's so much.
More than we can process. I know sometimes you're doing research and there's so much information, you just go.
Desensitized
or just hopeless. We're so swamped with choices, so swamped with information, so swamped with sensory input that one response is just to go blank. I'm sure there are experiments with monkeys where they overload them and they just...
That's why we have this path of focus.
Yeah. It's a good point. That there's so much that we, of course, a tendency is to focus. There's so much junk that we focus on something which is also junk. Which either is a video game or it's a career obsession or it's this or that. We focus. We shut out all the stuff that doesn't pertain to what we've chosen as our focal point. But that focal point is also ultimately meaningless. And that's another response. Maya gets you going this way, Maya gets you going that way. She's good at what she does.
And one of our devotees at the Krishna House also spoke about, in like Zen monks, they do...
Which monks?
Zen monks.
Mm-hmm.
They do single tasking, like we're so obsessed with multitasking all the time. Mm. A single tasking, and you can focus your mind even if you just do one thing at a time.
Mm.
So I think chanting, kirtan, these are all kind of...
Chanting, it comes in that category, yeah.
Or listening and...
Krishna says, aka Hakurunandan, that those who are determined focus their attention on one point. When our intelligence is many branched, we become a jack of all trades, master of none. So, if we want to achieve anything, it requires focus. And
what to speak of spiritual realization. They all get assigned.
Yeah, good point.
Yes?
So why is the focus on self-realization better than other focuses if that focus makes me happy?
Well, because that will make you happy temporarily. Now focus, material focus, and assuming it makes you happy, how long will it make you happy?
As long as I live.
Yeah. That's short. As long as you live. First of all, not true. Bunkum. It's not true. I find something that makes me happy and it makes me happy forever after. That's the fairy tale. I find a girl and we're happy forever. 50% we're happy for a few years and then we get divorced, usually in bitter legal proceedings. Otherwise, we stick with it, you know, for the sake of the kids or because, well, you know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know or for whatever other reason or because we like her. And then she gets old and maybe diseased or dies. There's no law that she has to live as long as you live. So what's this for the rest of your life thing? You got a guarantee that came with that? So first of all, it's not true. Usually what makes me happy for like, well, 10 minutes or an hour. You know, how long does your new car make you happy? Forever and ever? How long does your new job make you happy? How long does your new house make you happy? How long does anything make you happy?
Aren't the things that bring lasting happiness the things that are the hardest? I'm sorry. Aren't the things that bring the most lasting happiness the things that are really hard to achieve? And through trying to achieve those things, you have ups and downs and setbacks. And then when you finally achieve it, it feels really good.
Yeah. Aren't the things that give the most happiness the things that are hardest to achieve, where there are the most obstacles and it takes the longest? Yeah, we could say that.
So wouldn't like I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
But wouldn't like a marriage, for a woman that has ups and downs,
yeah.
And she can fulfill you and bring you happiness through those ups and downs and happy times?
Well, there's a certain sense to that. People expect marriage to be just unadulterated bliss, and then it's disappointing, you know, because after a week or a year or whatever it is, the sheen wears off, and then it's hard work and tough going, and she's not happy, and she doesn't know why she's not happy, or this or that or the other thing. So from that point of view, if a person sticks with it, the tendency is to say, pack it in. You know, find another girl, find one on the side, or just ditch this one and get the next one. And then you go from one to the next, and that's really unfulfilling. So the person who sticks it out and says, well, you know, I made a contract, and I'll stick with it through the ups and downs, through the good times and the bad times, he gets a more rewarding relationship. That's true. Because he's put up with, it's an austerity. It's an austerity. It's a more than an inconvenience. It's putting up with something that we don't like so much for the sake of a higher purpose. Not that I'll always not like my wife so much, but sometimes, you know, I wish she'd jump off a bridge. But I put up with it because there's a higher purpose.
There's family values, there's commitment, there's so many things, responsibility. So to put up with all the trouble, in Cockney slang, the wife is called trouble and strife. Mm. Yeah, I just got a call from my trouble and strife, Cockney slang. There's some wisdom in that. But the, that's putting up with some inconvenience for a higher purpose. But, and so we get some better, we get something better that way. But let's take marriage as an example. It's longer lasting than, you know, a visit to the pub or a visit to a brothel or what have you. But it's not forever. It's for some time. And it is subject to the law of, in many ways, diminishing returns. It's not all that it's cracked up to be. There's a certain amount of happiness there, a certain amount of unhappiness. It's like a package. It's not just great, great, great. It has so many miseries associated with it, along with that. And finally, someone says, no, in my case, there are no miseries. It's just the greatest thing I ever did, and I haven't regretted it for a minute, and so on. But then it'll be over. She'll lie and leave me brokenhearted, or I'll lie and leave her brokenhearted. And then what happens? I'm thinking only in terms of this one lifetime. But from the Vedic sages, we understand this one lifetime is a drop in the bucket. This is only part of our life. So that in this life, you know, I have my family, I have my home, and we're all together. But we've come together like little floating objects in the ocean that drift together and float together for some time and then drift apart. My mother goes to her next life, my father goes to his next life, I go to my next life, my sister goes to her next life, my brother goes to his next life, my wife. Everybody goes off in a different direction. And there's no saying what it may be. So in one sense, you know, we think of long-term commitment, long-term happiness, but what we think of generally as long-term, the sages think of as short-term. Or short-sighted, because we're only thinking of this one lifetime. And after this one lifetime, then what? So the sages ask us to think about that, to consider that, and not just view our life in terms of start and finish within 100 years or less, but to see the broader picture and say, what about that? So then they say, well, if you're going to take up some inconvenience or some voluntary austerity, take it up for that still higher purpose, where there's permanent happiness. We want permanent happiness. We don't want, you know, a car that's going to be rubble in a week. We don't want a relationship that's going to crumble. We want whatever's nice to last. That's our nature. We want it to be permanent. So the Vedic sages urge us to look for that place where the permanent happiness is to be found and not to be satisfied with happiness that comes and goes. That makes sense? Yeah.
Could you speak on... So we were talking about the romantic love that one has for one's partner and the problems with that. Can you speak a little bit about your understanding of the compassion that we have for we might want to cultivate for all human beings or for human beings and also the animals? Mm. What is the basis of that form of love?
Mm, good question. What's the basis of the compassion that we might feel for all living beings? For all human beings and animals, perhaps, where does that come from? The Bhagavad Gita says it comes from comparison to our own self. You know, I wouldn't want to be pinched,
so I can feel sympathy for others when they're pinched. I wouldn't want to be miserable in this way or that way. So I sympathize with others who are in that miserable situation. I can see myself in his shoes. And therefore I say, well, what can I do? So that natural sense of compassion, of sympathy for others is there, if it hasn't been deadened by ignorance, by passion, by material circumstances. But the Vedic literature looks and says that our compassion is often misplaced, that the compassion is filtered through a bodily concept of life. So in the bodily concept of life, I'm sympathetic for other human beings, but not for animals. Or I'm sympathetic for other Americans, but not for people of other countries. Or I'm sympathetic for this group and not that group. I'm sympathetic for people in my religion, but not your religion. My whatever it is, but not yours. Or so many. My family, but not your family. If I can, why am I working so hard? For my family, because I love my family. And to support my family, what am I doing? I'm screwing your family. So that sympathy is seen in terms of the bodily concept, is limited. Or if it's not limited that way, if it's a more expansive feeling, it's not just limited to my family or my country or my species. Still, the bodily concept of life, by which I mean I'm thinking that the material engagement is the self. I don't identify with the consciousness or soul within. I identify with the body in which that soul is living. That tendency is so strong that when I'm sympathetic, I'm sympathetic in terms of a bodily circumstance. So I want to build a hospital. I want to send a rescue mission for people who've been in an earthquake or a tornado. I want to help the victims of a flood, or I want to help cancer patients, or I want to help, on and on it goes. People who are in poverty, people who need education, people who are victims of political repression, on and on. That seeing is again in terms of the bodily concept of life. Because why am I in hunger? Why am I in poverty? Why am I under political repression? Why am I in this circumstance, that circumstance? Ultimately, it's because I'm not in my spiritual position. Because I've come to this material world, because I've become an embodied being, because I've forgotten my spiritual nature. Therefore, I'm subject to all of these material whips. And just to get me out of one of those circumstances doesn't get me out of the next one. There's a story, our spiritual master told a story that there was a man who was walking on the seashore, and he saw someone out there drowning. So he immediately dove in, swam out, and grabbed the man's shirt and came back to shore with a shirt. He sort of saved the shirt of the drowning man. So Srila Prabhupada used to say that this welfare work in the material context is like that. We save someone from this or that material circumstance. You know, you solve my economic problem, but then I have a drug problem. You solve my drug problem, but then I've got an educational problem. You solve my educational problem,
I have a social problem. Solve my social problem, I have a political problem. Solve my political problem, I get run over by a truck. So what has my welfare work done? It hasn't gotten to the root of the problem. And therefore, this problem will be replaced by that problem. On account of my karma, on account of my past activities, there are some reactions that will come, no matter what. I'll give you an example. That I was on a train in India one time, and a fellow passenger was a lady who was a professor. And this woman had gone to, where was that big earthquake some years back? Gujarat, I think?
In Pooch.
Maybe it was in Pooch. She'd gone there maybe at the behest of the government or behest of her university to see what was going on, because the central government of India had given massive relief funds. Because people, their homes were flattened, what kind of drinking water did they have, what were they doing to eat? They were devastated. Mm. They're just living in what had been their villages, nothing. So she told me that the central government gave, big relief package. From the central government, it went to the state government to administer the aid. From the state government, it went down to the district level. And from the district level, it was supposed to go down to that local level. So I thought, I know the story already. At each level. She said, no. Said the miracle was that actually everybody got the cash in their hand, which in India is absolutely miraculous. Everybody got the cash in their hand. Then what happened? The liquor dealers moved in. People were in such distress, and now they had money. So the liquor sellers came, and they got all the money. People solved their problem by drinking away their troubles. So even though the state made its best effort, didn't solve the problem. Somehow or other, on account of karma, people were destined to suffer. And the best efforts of the humanitarian and philanthropic workers couldn't undo it. As long as we're in this material world, the richest man, the best educated man, the most famous man, whoever, has to suffer. It's the nature of the material world. It's called dukkhalaya, a place where suffering is inevitable. There's miseries from my mind, miseries from my body, miseries from the environment. It's too hot, or it's too cold, or it's too much water, or not enough. And then there's miseries from other living entities, viruses and mosquitoes and rats and human beings. Well, these miseries are always upon us, either one or two or all three. Unavoidable as long as we're in this material environment. So the Vedic literature, the real welfare work, the real philanthropic work, is to deliver a person from the clutches of birth and death. If my real sympathy is there, that should be my goal.
Well, what does Krishna say about he who sees me in every tree and plant, I'm never far away?
Mm-hmm.
How does that go?
Yomam Pashyati Sarvatra, for one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I'm never lost, he's never lost to me.
Yeah, and then there's another one that I was thinking, I was relevant, was something about you like serving, when you're serving your fellow devotees, you're serving Krishna.
Yeah.
These are compassion.
Mm-hmm. see Krishna in the heart of everyone. That's spiritual vision, and therefore be sympathetic to everyone, but not superficially sympathetic, deeply sympathetic. If I really have, or you can say enlightened sympathy. There's a phrase, harm-giving kindness. Hmm. The kindness by which I try to help someone, but it actually causes harm. The Prabhupada gave the example that in his experience there was a boy who had typhoid. And the doctor said this boy has to fast. I don't know, typhoid treatment, but anyway, he was told he had to fast. Then, so, his parents went out for some brief time. And then the boy was pleading with his brother, I'm so hungry, couldn't you just give me a little cake? I said, why not? And then the boy, you know, practically died. Contraindicated. So the intention was good, but the result wasn't very good. So sometimes we're trying to be kind to others by making, we say, we want to make this a better world. Give people a better life. But it's a better material life. It's a better material world. So we want to take their jail cell. We say, this is a terrible jail cell with iron bars. It would be so much better if they were silver. Yeah, we want to give you a better life. There's a story. There was a boatman. In India, they have these canals. And the way that you get the boat through the canal is you've got a post on the front of your boat. You've got a rope on the post. Throw the rope ashore, and there's some guys dragging the rope and dragging your boat through the canal. Maybe two guys. So there's a man who's doing that work, and he thinks, if I ever get rich, I'm going to line the bank of this river with pillows. So that instead of being so afflicted, my feet will be comfortable. He doesn't think that if I'm rich, why am I going to be pulling these boats? if I get any money, I'll line the bank with pillows. So we're thinking how to make this a better world. But this isn't the world that will become better. The real business, the real aim should be how to go beyond this world to the place where there's no birth, no death, no old age, no disease. That's real kindness to ourselves and to others. Is that okay? Yeah.
So when you talk about the word where there is no birth, no death,
a world where there's no birth, no death,
yeah. It requires a leap of faith.
A leap of faith. Well, it doesn't require, you know, all this leaping is not really required. It requires thoughtfulness. You know, suddenly, in spiritual matters, everything's supposed to be a leap of faith. In the material world, everything's rational. It's a baloney. Everything we do in the material world, there's some faith involved. You pay, you know, you put $100 on a counter for your airplane ticket, and they give you a little piece of paper. And you have faith that you're going to get on an airplane and go to San Francisco. Or Prabhupada used to say, man lies back in the barber chair, and he's lying back like this, and there's a guy standing over him with a razor in his throat. You can't do anything without faith. Your mother gives you a glass of water. Well, I don't know. How do I know that this water is really water? There are so many instances where someone has poisoned someone. How do I know? I guess I'll take a leap of faith. Our daily life,
How much money does one spend to attend this university? Substantial investment. And he's told that when you get out, you know, you'll have something worthwhile. He doesn't know. But you spend 4 years of your life and so much of your money or your parents' money, or you get into student loans and your postgraduate experience is already one of debt. There's no guarantee, but out of faith. So there's faith in everything. There's also reason in everything. Why should I go to this university? Why should I drink this stuff or not drink that stuff? If there's intelligence, and there's faith both in the ordinary life. So why, when we come to spiritual questions, now it's all leap of faith. Either we have to just jump in because faith tells us, I had a dream. Or we have to reject the whole thing because otherwise it would be taking a leap of faith, and faith is not, is the enemy of rationality, and blah, 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 blah. So in the Bhagavad Gita, there's so much philosophy, there's logic, there's reason, everything is there. It's not that Krishna says, my dear Arjun, believe. Believe, Arjun. Arjun, believe. There's logic, there's argument, there's questions, there's answers, there's objections. There's so much philosophy. It's not just leap of faith. And at the same time, some element of faith is there. If I'm going to challenge every word, if I'm going to challenge everything and be against everything you say before you even say it, I'm not going to understand very much. So the usual reasonable mixture of faith and intelligence has to be there. If we hold our intelligence in abeyance, then what we accept, we'll reject tomorrow. It'll be sentiment. Today I come on sentiment, I believe. And tomorrow I leave on sentiment. Ah, it's all cheating. So intelligence is there. Krishna is giving the example that you had a child's body, now you have a young person's body, later you have an old person's body, you're changing your body. If I ask to see your child's body, you can't use the goods. So you're changing from body to body to body, but you're the same person. You remember when you were a child. You'll remember later what's going on now. The same consciousness is there. So consciousness is existing. It's not created by any material means. I can't supply this ingredient, that ingredient to some scientists and say, make me consciousness. Nor can consciousness be destroyed by any physical means. You can't cut it, you can't dry it, you can't blow it away, you can't drown it, you can't burn it. So Krishna is giving us different ways to understand that consciousness is a non-material substance. It's the opposite in quality to what we have. We speak of things coming and going. The implication is that there's something that doesn't come and go. When I say that something's temporary, it implies that something's permanent. What meaning does temporary have unless there's something permanent? The two terms reference one another. So the Vedic sages don't look at it and say, what is it that's permanent and what is it that's temporary? And they look at it and they say, the body is temporary, it comes and goes. It has a beginning, it has an end. But the consciousness within the body is permanent. That's not faith leaping, that's philosophy. Does that make sense? I wonder what other questions might be bubbling up here.
same point about the relative terms, that if you say something's temporary, that means there has to be something of permanent value. You know, can't the scientist just say that, yeah, there's something of relative permanence, that it's not eternal, the soul isn't eternal, but it, something can be relatively permanent compared to something else, like a
relatively permanent.
Well, like
that implies relative to something else again. You're getting into a regress of things that are temporary, a little less temporary, or last for a while, last longer, last longer, last longer. So then we can ask, well, what is it that lasts the longest? What is it that lasts the longest? And you say, well, consciousness lasts the longest. Throughout my life, everything comes and goes. I've been through so many cars, or so many laptops, or so many shoes, or so many bodies. But consciousness, the fact of my existence, is persistent. So then one should inquire about that. What is this persistent self? I'm looking at the shoes, I'm looking at the cars, I'm looking at the laptops, I'm looking at the governments, I'm looking at this, I'm looking at that, all the things that come and go. What about this self, which is so persistent? The nature of the self should be investigated. That's the Vedic contention.
I'm wondering about like different techniques, different types of yoga,
mm-hmm.
and like you mentioned about if your attention is many branched and you're a jack of all trades, master of none. But I don't know. I like to practice different types of techniques and things, and you know what I really would just like Prabhupada say about combining techniques. And it's not a good idea.
Well, the first question is what your goal is.
There's different goals.
Yeah, there are different goals and therefore different techniques.
Yeah. And okay. Well, because even like within Krishna consciousness, we have different techniques.
Yeah.
You know, we have our kirtan and our chanting and
mm-hmm.
our deity worship and mm-hmm. food and stuff. So it's just a matter of what falls underneath certain categories. And, you know,
no. Anyone is good. Someone's more attached to chanting, someone's more attached to hearing, someone's more attached to deity worship, someone's more attached to serving. So anyone that fully occupies our attention.
In different rasas.
Yeah, rasa doesn't necessarily, yeah, maybe in a different rasa, but even in the same rasa, someone likes to hear more. His rasa, his relationship is maybe friendship or maybe servanthood, but what he likes to do is hear. Someone else in the same relationship, he likes to chant. Someone else in the same relationship, he likes to offer prayers. Someone else, so in whatever relationship, there are 9 different methods of serving. And any one of them is good. As soon as one is completely engaged in any one of the 9, or 2 or 3 or 4, that's fine. Hearing and chanting have been emphasized because they're so effective. So usually the other items will be nourished by hearing and chanting. The teachers, the acharyas, have especially emphasized hearing and chanting. But someone likes these other methods, they're all good. But the yoga, different kinds of yogas, let's take like Ashtanga yoga.
Yeah.
Someone says, well, I like Ashtanga yoga. Okay, well, let's look at Ashtanga yoga. Shucho deshe pratishtapya sthira masana matmaha natyutritam natyanicha kailajana kushotram. In the 6th chapter, it's described what you do for this yoga. Shucho deshe, first you go to a sacred place. You know, forget the gym in downtown with the girls and the leotards and all that stuff.
You have to go to a sacred place.
Hardwar, Rishikesh, banks of the Ganges, some very quiet, very pure, very sacred place.
Then you have to have a seat which is not too high, not too low. Put down a deer skin and soft cloth. And then you have to sit with your neck and back and head erect, with your eyes half open and half closed so that you don't fall asleep and you don't get distracted. You fix that vision on the tip of your nose. That's the beginning. That's the beginning. Brahmachari, no sex, that's out of the question. Brahmachari, taste it. Then you have to follow these different methods. Yam, niyam, asana, pratyahara. Pratyahara means to shut out all the external sense objects. Breathing exercises. Breathing exercises where just people hold their nose and go, that's not really pranayama. Pranayama means you offer the incoming breath into the outgoing breath, and vice versa, until you reach equilibrium and your breath stops. The yogis, they don't need to breathe anymore. They've reached equilibrium by drilling their respiration. So when you reach that, then you've really got control of your senses. And then they can propel themselves to this very high state. Focus the mind in this powerful meditation on the Lord within the heart. So it's a kind of mechanical exercise. First you do this, then you do this, then you do this. That's very powerful. And who's going to do it? Arjuna, who is the personal friend of Krishna, said, my dear Krishna, this seems too much. I can't do it. And who are we? So then we adopt some simple thing, hot tub yoga or, $30 a session or go home feeling great. That's a whole other story.
Yeah, it's for different goals sometimes. Like, for me, my bodily maintenance, if my body is working better, it tends to be like my mind and my spirit will be better.
Yeah, for that, the Hatha Yoga is great. It's actually this system of yoga that's popular in the West with the asanas and all that.
Yeah.
From what I've read, it was actually derived from British military exercises that were adopted by a South Indian teacher.
Yeah, and gymnastics and stuff. But
yeah.
But you want it to be combined with keeping your mind focused on divine. See, otherwise it's just exercise. Otherwise it's not yoga. It's just stretching and gymnastics.
Yeah, it's basically gymnastics with meditation in it.
Yeah, so that's why I'll sometimes even be chanting a mantra, be chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra in my mind if I'm in a particularly challenging pose, because it calms.
Yeah, whatever. If you're doing jumping jacks or yoga postures or bicycling or running or whatever it is that you do for your health, and chant Hare Krishna. Whatever you do, chant Hare Krishna. But the thing itself is not particularly valuable for spiritual realization, but for health it's good from that point of view.
I see.
And I wonder, let's see how we're doing here. We go till, what time did you say?
5. 5,
okay, we still have time. And I wonder what other questions might be percolating. Otherwise, I can go home early, I don't get paid by the hour anyway.
Some evidence about reincarnation.
one book, there's like a library. Ian Stevenson, late professor of personality studies at the University of Virginia, he wrote Cases of the Reincarnation Type, which I think is like 7 volumes. 10 cases of suggestive of reincarnation, 1 volume. 2 thick volumes on the intersection between biology and reincarnation. A lot of books.
So sometimes in those books, I read some cases where the person was shot in the neck, next life you would have a mark on the neck or something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the body's left behind, so how does that, I mean, why does...
Well, that's a very interesting question. How are these things carried over? How are these things carried over? And these were some, this was a question, of course, that he asked. But it seems, that was the first thing, that there seems to be a relationship between a child who remembers a past life, or seems to remember a past life, and the physical, these physical signs, birthmarks or birth defects. There's a correspondence. As a scientist, he looks and says, well, here's something interesting. Here's this child who's talking about this and this and this and this. And here's this deceased person to whom those particular facts apply. And here are these unusual marks on the body of the child. And here are corresponding marks on the body of the deceased person. And you look at those two sets of data and you say, well, there's got to be some sort of relationship. So his working hypothesis was that there was a conscious being, a soul, who formerly inhabited one body and then came to inhabit the next body. Now, why the carrying over of the bodily signs? Good question. I don't know. Perhaps because the child's, you know, it's our thought. The body actually grows around our mind. The what you think of becomes your next body. Maharaj died thinking of a deer, and the next life he got the body of a deer. So our consciousness influences, or it said, adhisthanam manaschayam vishayanupasevate utkramantam sthitam vapi bhunjanam bhagunanvitam. The vimuta nanupashanti, pashanti gyanachakshusha. The fools can't see it, but those who have eyes of knowledge see that the consciousness is traveling from one life to another, picking up different impressions, the way the air picks up aromas. The air is pure. The air by itself has no scent, but it travels over a rose garden and then it comes in your window smelling like roses. Or it travels over the fish market and comes to your window smelling like fish. Because it subtly picks up these scents. So Krishna says in a similar way, the mind carries with it these impressions that it's picked up. And travel, you know, we experience that in our life also. Psychiatry and psychology were talking about, you know, the things that have been in my mind since I was a child and now are influencing. Fair enough. These things are kept in the mind. And at the time of death, there's a transfer. The consciousness travels to the new body, but the new body's built on the mind. So one might theorize that in these exceptional circumstances, and a large proportion of Stevenson's cases dealt with violent death, where the child remembered a life that had been terminated violently. So one might hypothesize that under those circumstances, the impression of that incident was very strong in the mind, and that it would influence the next body.
I'm just, you know, that's a sort of speculative approach to the question.
I have another, oh, go ahead, Jack.
If it's following up on that, please go ahead.
Yeah, it's just following up, it's that not only just the mind, but like we have, you know, the subtle bodies. So we have physical body, then we have the subtle body, the aura that can like contain that trauma.
That's all counted within the mind.
Yeah.
How do I need it?
Okay.
All that subtle stuff. That's in the mental world. I met Stevenson, by the way, one time at a conference in Texas. In parapsychology, the question of whether some aspect of human personality continues after physical death is called the survival question. He said to me, we were talking, he said, I think the survival question matters, don't you?
We, in the beginning of the discussion, you mentioned how even goodness, out of goodness, passion, and ignorance, even goodness is considered bondage from the spirit's
mm-hmm.
point of view.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning of devotional practice, we are still bound by these modes. And so someone who's very contented in their position in the mode of goodness may look at a beginning practitioner of spiritual life and say, oh, look how frustrated this person is. And yet, on like from another angle, the person who's spiritually oriented is in a better position.
Well, a person who's in the mode of goodness would be more inclined to look and see, there's somebody who's doing something for making spiritual progress. Goodness means knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So why should a person in goodness look at a spiritual practitioner and say, I have whatever?
I see. So what is it then that makes a person very clean, very peaceful, but also very critical of theologically oriented people?
Passion and ignorance. Goodness, these modes, Krishna says, are not pure in the material world. Sometimes, what is that? Sattvam. What is that? That is sattvam tata. Rajas tamas chavi bhumiyo sattvam bhavati bharata, rajas sattvam tamas chaiva, tamas sattvam rajas tata. Sometimes passion comes up and ignorance and goodness go down. Sometimes goodness comes up and passion and ignorance go down. Sometimes ignorance goes up and passion and goodness go down. So they're mixing like colors. You don't find in this world pure goodness. So when goodness is mixed with passion and ignorance, you get a person who's feeling, organic food and peaceful life and non-violence. What's the stupid guy doing, reading the Upanishads? His passion or his ignorance? The critical mentality. That critical mentality often comes from the mode of ignorance. What's the word? And Bhagavad-gita said that this is the symptom, a sign of a person in ignorance is that he's expert in criticizing others. Now everybody's a fool. In the Bible, there's a verse where it says that the person who's ignorant, even when he walks on the road, announces to everyone that he's a fool. Then the commentators have taken it two ways. One is that you can see by the way he acts that he's a fool.
And the other way that they've taken it, given the ambiguous program, is that he says to everybody else, "You're a fool." Announces to everyone else that he's a fool.
Hmm.
He's so foolish, he thinks everyone else is a fool.
Hmm.
So that's a sign of ignorance. Everyone's a fool but me.
So when is there just criticism? When is the criticism, like Prabhupada says, in one place, a spade should be called a spade. So when is it okay, or sometimes we say it should be?
For someone's benefit. It's not criticism for my ego, for my sense gratification. Just like the teacher criticizes the student. That's good for the student. The teacher doesn't criticize him. How will the student learn? So the spiritual master, the teacher, it's their job sometimes to criticize. Or in other circumstances, you call in a business analyst. You didn't call him in just to say, "You're doing great in your business. I've never seen a business that's so well run and where such good decisions are made." You want him to criticize. Otherwise, what's the use of it? So sometimes criticism is wanted, but just the tendency to criticize, you know, a person whose life is to bitch about everything and everyone, and not to have introspection, to see his own shortcomings, that's a sign of ignorance. A little more to your tongue. Thank you all very much.